This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. At the suggestion of our listeners, this podcast will focus on the management of long-term care residents with diabetes. According to a 2015 Centers for Disease Control survey, in nearly half of the United States, and mostly in the South and West Coast regions, greater than 20% of adults over the age of 75 have a diagnosis of diabetes. And despite preventative medicine efforts, we find that of those elders, there are still significant issues with obesity, physical inactivity, and hypertension and cholesterol awareness. Diabetes rates in long-term care mirror or exceed community rates, but the impact and management of diabetes in the setting is more complicated and often blurred. In response to the unique environment that long-term care poses, the American Diabetes Association endorsed a detailed 2016 position statement by Dr. Meeta Munshi and others entitled Management of Diabetes in Long-Term Care and Skilled Nursing Facilities. This position statement breaks down diabetes management into the domains of general approaches to care, goals and strategies, issues around transitions and end of life, and integration into long-term care facilities. For those of us Joe AMDAs in the trenches caring for elders in long-term care, managing diabetes is still somewhat confusing an approach. How do we navigate away from the dogma of our training in diabetes care and look further into the true needs or requirements of our unique patients? To help create a clearer path, geriatrician and endocrinologist Dr. Noshira Pandya is with us now. Dr. Pandya is a professor and chair of geriatrics for the Dr. Kiran C. Patel College of Osteopathic Medicine at Nova Southeastern University, or NSU, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Dr. Pandya is an educator, fellowship director, researcher, certified medical director, and a past president of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Dr. Pandya, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Dr. Pandya, Linda Haas, in her 2014 Diabetes Spectrum article entitled Special Considerations for Older Adults with Diabetes Residing in Skilled Nursing Facilities, highlighted the potentially complicated diabetes picture that elders in long-term care portray, not just in regard to newly discovered versus long-standing diabetes, but issues, multiple issues. Protein, energy, malnutrition, sarcopenia, dysphagia, hydration, glucose monitoring, cognition, depression, polypharmacy, and on and on and on. Otherwise, all the issues that we deal with in elders every day, where do we start in evaluating or understanding individual residents and or the nursing facility population of residents? How can nursing, medical directors, and attending advanced practice teams work together to address this heterogeneous population around diabetes management? Do we need protocols and policies to facilitate care? It's complicated.
Yeah, the more I read take care of my own patients, it doesn't get any simpler. But I think what you said is to recognize heterogeneity and to approach each patient individually. While good practice guidelines, you know, have been developed by our organization and the ADA and others, we still need to recognize that even within the long-term care facility, there are three distinct populations. You know, the patients who are there for rehab therapy and are short stay and generally more fit, I would say, and then the long-term patients, and thirdly, those who receive palliative care and those who are at the end of life. So I think you always first have to look at where that patient is in that in our post-acute setting, and what is their goal. And not to mention some other, you know, confounding factors. Not only do we have age, we need to recognize that with age there is, of course, increased risk of diabetes, but even within the population with diabetes, as time goes on, they have a decline in beta cell function, so they're less and less able to produce insulin. So we have to tailor our therapies. To put it bluntly, you cannot keep flogging the pancreas forever in all our patients, because they're no longer able to produce insulin. We have to recognize that. I look at each patient with some three important things. What is their risk for hypoglycemia, which is really coming to the forefront? So what's their risk of hypoglycemia? What are their functional limitations? You know, propensity to fall, incontinence, vision and hearing problems. And what is their life expectancy? Because I think if you try and cohort patients into those with a poor prognosis, multiple complications, functional and cognitive impairment, you will start then selecting a different approach and a different A1C goal, different frequency of monitoring, and also simplification of therapeutic agents. Whereas if you look at your, you know, rehab patient who might have a much better prognosis and the plan is to send them home, then you're looking at, you know, what were they able to achieve in terms of glycemic control prior to their hospital stay, prior to the rehab stay? What can they manage? Can they manage one injection a day? Can they manage multiple dose insulin? How much help do they have at home? So that will help us kind of tailor the goals to where the patient is. And then in the long-term care population for whom the nursing home is their home, they also have a slow decline as time goes on. And we have to look at their functional status, their cognition, their propensity to have acute complications, and then decide on you know, how we're going to approach them. And we can talk about specific goals later.
But essentially what you're saying is that we need to do a geriatric assessment and when it comes to diabetic management.
Yes, and I think, I mean, as geriatricians, we sometimes do this instinctively. We look at, we try to gauge life expectancy. We look at what, how many geriatric syndromes they have. Do they have functional and cognitive impairment? Because, you know, there's so much similarity in the older adult with diabetes and the geriatric patient in terms of the geriatric syndromes that they have. There's so much commonality between those two populations.
You know, you've mentioned cognition and functional status a couple of times, and you have authored on diabetic management under those umbrellas. And recently, in a 2018 geriatric nursing article entitled "Optimizing Insulin Delivery for Patients with Diabetes," you and others actually get granular with the actual administration of insulin in long-term care.
Yes.
But there continue to be so many questions now about management with insulin in the long-term care resident, whether it's basal or prandial. Questions like, you know, should we be using insulin sliding scale at all? What are acceptable hemoglobin A1C values in a long-term care resident? Should we even be checking hemoglobin A1Cs, cutoffs for acceptable blood sugars? And for those of us in the trenches, we know that, you know, we get the call at 9 o'clock, they checked a bedtime blood sugar for whatever reason, and it's 350, and what do you want to do? You know, should we be using oral agents in this population? You know, so I guess what I'm getting at with all these questions is, you know, in your opinion, what is the leading medication practice in diabetic management today in this population?
Yeah, Dr. Salzman, there are about 15 questions.
I know. This is a challenging podcast.
So I think I am guided, you know, in our AMDA clinical practice guideline, we really took a stab in territories that other guidelines did not address. The practical approach, you know, when to call the physician, how often should we check blood sugars, you know, how often should we check an A1C. Of course, other professional organizations have really given us good guidance on what A1C goals should be. But I think we took on the challenge of providing practical guidance for the practitioner and the interprofessional team in the nursing home. And so we provide some guidelines as to how often blood sugar should be checked on people on multiple dose insulin, at least twice a day, on oral agents, no more than 3 to 5 blood sugars a week. Patients at the end of life, in our ADA position statement, we really said monitoring should be decreased and even stopped if the patient refuses. I think, again, one has to look at the population you're dealing with. Let me deal with goals of control. I think it's still fair to say that in the long-term care population, an A1C less than 8% for our or less than 8 to 8.5%. I think that number has kind of grown a little bit. Less than 8.5% for those who are long-term patients who have functional and cognitive impairment and require a lot of care, that's reasonable. And so what does that translate? So fasting and pre-meal glucose targets, so throughout the day between 100 to 200 is reasonable. The same goal is reasonable for your short-term rehab patients. If you can stay within 100 to 200 fasting or before meals, I think we're in good territory. Mm-hmm. Blood glucose is over 200, impair the immune response, nosocomial infections increase, and we know that from hospital literature.
Right.
And patients at the end of life, we're not focused on any glucose targets, but we want to avoid extreme hyperglycemia, worsening infections, worsening wounds, and osmotic diuresis. Mm. So in that position statement, we made a recommendation, which was empiric but sensible, that if the blood glucose in end-of-life patients is over 300, just give them an empiric 4 units of rapid-acting insulin. They may or may not be on a basal insulin. Now, as far as what is happening with therapy, I think it's worth making this point that there's been a significant change of thinking in terms of how should we treat diabetes pharmacologically. Drugs like metformin are still at the forefront, and many of our residents, we can still use metformin. We have to reduce the dose if their GFR is less than 45, and we stop it if it's less than 30, but we can still get a good mileage out of metformin. The other drugs, such as SGLT2 inhibitors, canagliflozin and the like, they're certainly useful because they increase glycosuria. But then we have to pick our battles. Can that patient tolerate the osmotic diuresis? Do they have impaired thirst? And are they going to get volume depleted? But so basal insulins and the weekly GLP-1s, like dulaglutide and similar agents, have really come to the forefront. And many people are saying that we should manage these people not with multiple dose. We were all on the basal prandial insulin bandwagon. That we should try to manage them with one dose of basal insulin plus one or two oral agents, if possible. And if that's not enough, we should add a weekly GLP-1. And we should try and get away from these multiple dose regimens, which include, basal insulin and rapid-acting insulin before meals.
Wow.
And the rationale is, we know that patients won't often eat the same amount at each meal. Patients might miss meals. They have nausea, GI symptoms, anorexia, swallowing difficulties, and also the complexity of these regimens. So in the ADA position statement, we really emphasize that the regimen should be simplified. Your statement, well, you get called with blood sugars that might be 350 one night, and it's very tempting to change the whole regimen after a day or two. Well, I think we have to resist that temptation. We are not trying anymore for perfect glucose levels at every glucose check. I think that we have to get away from. Certainly, if somebody's septic, severe infection, we want frequent glucose checks. We will use rapid-acting insulin.
Right.
But for your stable patient, that's not what we're trying for. We're trying for better trends overall, and we're not going to micromanage every single blood glucose. And that, you know, takes a teamwork. So if you have a group of colleagues and your nurse practitioners are on call, you all have to agree that that's not what you're going to do.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, the only foundation dedicated to advancing the field and practice of post-acute and long-term care medicine. Our foundation is totally unique in focusing on issues of competence, quality, and the value we bring to patients in this setting. Please support the foundation at paltcfoundation.org.
We're talking with Dr. Nashira Panja about diabetic management and long-term care. Dr. Panja, in the Haas article referenced above, there are discussions around the rates of diabetic patients' acute care transitions based on medication changes, polypharmacy, formulary issues, and the ever-challenging medication reconciliation. What's the role of the clinical or consultant pharmacist in long-term care, or what could that role be to optimize care for this complex population around diabetes management? After all, regardless of how ubiquitous insulin is in healthcare today, it is still a high-risk medication. Should there be greater effort to monitor and manage medications more closely or appropriately in the skilled nursing setting by a clinical pharmacist?
I think that you've hit upon a really important point. And I know this collaboration, has various levels of depth and intensity in different settings. But I think this is the perfect example of a physician or a physician pharmacist partnership, along with your primary nurse or the nurse manager, can be a really unbeatable team because you're all watching the patient from different perspectives. And I think the consultant pharmacist can be a very important person when a new patient comes in or there's a readmission to, again, check the medications. If there's been a brand change, what is equivalent? If they're on one basal insulin, can we use another? And don't forget, now we have second generation basal insulins, insulin glargine, that is 300 units per ml, and degludec, which is 200 units per ml of Detemir. So, we can together make a selection. We can, use a different brand if that's what the facility provides. We can really develop goals in a week or two to stop sliding scale insulin if they've come in with sliding scale insulin, and there are specific recommendations on how to do that. And I think the pharmacist is a key person, along with the nurse, to watch out for glucose trends, because by the time you do a visit, you may miss all the extreme glucose variability, which is important. I think the pharmacist can also help you if you're doing a QI, a monitor on diabetes, such as, episodes of hypoglycemia, ER visits related to diabetes, excess number of infections. I think a consultant pharmacist is very, very useful, is a really useful member of the team. And nice. I think we often don't use them enough. And that takes, you have to develop a relationship and define, common goals. And they too may have different beliefs and, different thresholds for treating patients.
I am a firm advocate, and I know all my colleagues are, on the role of the clinical pharmacist. It just is the work to getting them to play that role that we need in the skilled nursing setting.
They're looking to taking more initiative in managing the patient, and this is where we can use their skills.
Absolutely. In the time we have remaining, I want to talk about something you have touched on a couple of times, and that's more end of life or palliation. In a 2015 McKnight's Long-Term Care News profile of you, in which you were noted to be fiercely protective of patients who may no longer be able to advocate for themselves, recognize that technology ability shouldn't dictate the use of invasive treatments, and believe that palliative or hospice services had their place in long-term care. I recently cared for a patient admitted to routine hospice, and I suggested at this point that insulin was no longer a benefit and should be discontinued. The family was incredulous at the suggestion. How could that possibly be? Do you believe that advanced care planning in and out of the long-term care setting should apply to diabetes management as well?
Yeah, I think that this is a really important issue. I mean, it should be maybe not disease specific, but it should be part of the discussion with the family as the patient, it's realized by the team that the patient is not doing well, is not benefiting from, you know, recurrent admissions, that management of diabetes, just as we would, for an oncologist or a physician might say, well, how aggressive are we going to be about chemotherapy, or how aggressive are we going to be about heart failure? I think we should discuss with the family, you know, about the lack of benefit of intensive monitoring of multi-dose insulin, that our goals have shifted to preventing hypoglycemia or extreme hyperglycemia. And I think we should translate that into patient comfort and dignity. Those are the big issues. And even going further, I mean, you encountered the opposite, but I sometimes encounter a complete refusal from the family or the patient to have any monitoring done, or any further doses of insulin. And I think we have to respect that. I think in our position statement, there's a good pointer where if you're doing periodic monitoring, which can be, you know, once a day or three times a week, if you see that blood glucose over 300 where osmotic diuresis becomes a problem, just giving 4 units of rapid-acting insulin is a reasonable thing to do. We need to translate our care of diabetes. It is an end-of-life issue. We have to help the family and the patient understand that more is not necessarily better.
Absolutely. I believe that's a geriatric mantra.
A lot of these patients are already in organ failure. And of course, you know, liver failure, renal failure make the use of insulin and other anti-diabetic agents, you know, quite risky.
Absolutely. We'll let that be the last word. We have been so fortunate to speak with and glean the expertise of geriatrician and endocrinologist Dr. Nashira Panja, Professor and Chief of Geriatrics at NSU. Dr. Panja, thank you so much for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.